Just like you need to exercise regularly, eat a balanced diet, and get periodic checkups for your physical health, you should do the same for your business's financial health. This week on the Creative Genius Podcast, Gail Dobie sits down with Walter Russell, a financial planner with his own business, Russell & Associates, that offers financial planning services. If you're a small business owner, you'll want to hear what Walter thinks the most important financial matters are for a business of your size.
Well, Walter, welcome to our podcast. We're excited to talk to you. We haven't really talked to too many financial people, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So let's talk about first, what is a certified financial planner?
A certified financial planner, it's basically a designation where an individual has passed a board exam done by the CFP board, and it's based on your education, your work experience, and you have to pass like 7 or 8 different disciplines to get the exam. It usually takes about 2 to 3 years of study, and you usually need 5 years of previous work experience in the financial services industry.
Mm. Well, what took you that direction? What was it that attracted you to that field?
So really, when I was growing up as a kid in Cleveland, Ohio, I came across a funny movie called Trading Spaces with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. Mm-hmm. At that time, Eddie Murphy was my favorite comedian / actor, and they were trading commodities in that movie, frozen orange juice, wheat, corn, and you know, as a kid growing up in the inner city of Cleveland, I had no idea that people did that for a living. At the end of the movie, they were able to walk away with a large sum of money. And, you know, being from an unfortunate background, you know, money was a goal to have. So I started researching, you know, the investment market and everything else like that. So that became, you know, kind of like my first love is, you know, hey, how can I make money? You know, to provide a living for myself.
Great. And being a certified financial planner, I'm sure you see a lot of different things along the way. And not everybody is ready to use your kinds of services. So when is somebody ready for you?
I generally tell people that you should start planning at a beginning age. I remember when I was in, I think, sixth grade at the time, and we were supposed to pick a stock and watch it for, you know, the whole year. Well, at the time, I didn't know anything about stocks, and the company I picked was IBM. And I think back then, in sixth grade, IBM was trading at like $20 a share. It's currently trading at, let's say, $188 a share. It's gone and split multiple times. So what I tell people is the sooner you sit down with the financial planner, the better it will be for you and your loved ones, because our job is to give you advice and kind of hold your feet to the fire to help you plan for whatever your goals are. Generally, the number one goal people have is, you know, planning for retirement, or second is getting their kids to school. Well, I always encourage people to start planning as quickly and as soon as possible, because that's going to help you achieve those goals.
Mm-hmm. I think some people, and I was probably one of those, I probably didn't start as early as I should have. Luckily, it's worked out okay. But I think for a lot of people, they think, oh, I've got plenty of time. I don't need to start this right away. And what do you tell them?
I always tell people, you know, my dad, he had a big trailer, you know, he would pull it with the station wagon. I think this was like a 30-foot trailer that we would pull going all across the United States. And one of the things I loved as a kid was we would always stop at the AAA station and we would get those trip tickets. I don't know if you remember those. And it would kind of chart your course. And I always tell people that's what financial planning is. Is, you know, you want to go to Florida in the next 6 weeks. There's many routes. There's many directions that you can go. There's construction areas. But that's what a financial planner is to kind of be your guide. The guiding you through from point A to point B. That's why I encourage people to start as quickly as possible when you're planning. Generally speaking, I generally see people wait till they're in their late 50s, early 60s. Hey, I want to retire in the next 2 to 3 years. What do I need to do? And I generally have to tell a lot of people, you need to continue to keep on working. I wish we would have talked, you know, in your 40s and your 30s and kind of going from there. And I think part of the people in America, because we don't really like to talk about income goals or debt or anything else like that, because that's a private conversation. That's why we see a lot of hesitancy when people want to sit down with us, because they don't really want to reveal, you know, what they've been doing.
Mm-hmm. And they probably don't want somebody telling them, you can't spend your money on things. You need to put it in savings, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you can't spend all, you know, the Amazon guy needs to stop coming to your house every day. So that's generally what we run into. Yeah.
Or Starbucks.
Yeah.
And they're little things, but I think about it. And I know that when I talk to a lot of people who are in their 30s and 40s, they haven't really started saving. And it worries me, because I know that if you're just starting later in life, you may or may not have enough money to pay for your retirement. And today, people are living longer. So
Yeah. And we ran into that because I don't know if you were aware of this, but the fastest portion of our population, growing portion, is people that are 65 plus. Mm-hmm. We are currently at a point in time where there are more 65-year-old people in the world than there are people below the age of 5. And, you know, when we started looking at statistics and, you know, especially, you know, looking at women are living past 100 years of age. And that's something that we've seen as, you know, unheard of. And the statistics keep on showing us, with the breakthroughs in medicine and everybody trying to, you know, watch their diet and, you know, making cutbacks and having a more active retirement lifestyle, chances are people, you know, are going to live a lot longer. I think statistics are showing us by 2090, the average woman's going to live to 90 years of age, and the average male will be at 87. That's going to be up from 2021, probably about 5 to 7 years. And that's on average.
But when I look at people who are younger and I think about, wow, if they're going to make it to 95 or 100, then how much do they really need to have in savings in order to fund a comfortable lifestyle? And Social Security may or may not be there by the time they get through, because my generation is still, we've got the biggest generation, as you said. And so we're going to be the ones using up a lot of those funds in the government.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And so one of the biggest things that I talk to husbands and wives, or, you know, partners, is that at some point in time, one of you guys are going to pass away. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing that we run into, the roadblock is that if, you know, partner A has, or let's just say you're in your situation, your husband, he's been managing all the finances. Well, God forbid, if he passes away, you know, that's not only are you losing a loss of a loved one, but then now you have to kind of change gears and now you have to be more involved. So that's part of the job as the financial planner, is I believe I need to educate, because that's part of the weakness that we can see in a financial planning strategy, is that how do we educate the, you know, the other half of the equation that is, doesn't really care about the stock market, doesn't care about anything. And, you know, and when we do see some, you know, the loved one pass away, we can run into some major tax implications. Case in point, I've seen tons of times where, you know, just for example, a wife didn't realize that her husband had an IRA of $400,000. She goes in the bank, she talks to somebody, they sell her XYZ product. Well, the product isn't titled correctly, and that $400,000 all becomes taxable at one event. Well, once you do something like that, you know, it cannot be undone. And those are the things that I get worried about. And that's what I try to do, is let's build a plan so that if something happens to A, that B is going to be protected. And how do we do that? We have to educate B. And, you know, we do it in small doses. So for some of my clients, you know, I've got this one client, they reside in, let's say, Florida. His wife doesn't care about anything about the market, but we are meeting on a monthly basis to educate her. Now, they're small doses. You know, we do it on Zoom, you know, 20, 30 minutes, and we're just talking about topics. The goal is that over the next 10 to 15 years, we're putting her in a better position to, you know, manage this entire wealth that they have amassed.
Yeah. Well, it's important to think about. And it's so interesting because my husband and I chatted about it while I was on a sabbatical. And I said, well, I should really, let's review where things are and let's review how do I get into your computer? Because he has access to all the accounts. It sounds like such a simple thing, but something you need to be sure you have that. And are those things that you help people try to figure out?
Yeah. So case in point, one of my clients, his father passed away and he had cancer and, you know, he had his little scrapbook right by the computer where he wrote down all these passwords. It took his wife probably a year to get access to every one of their accounts. And the reason is because she couldn't distinguish what's the, you know, if it was a C, a 6, a 9, an R. And, you know, she didn't think about that. So this happened probably 9-10 years ago. And that forced me to course correct and make some changes because, generally speaking, there's usually, let's just say, one who is, you know, does all the lion's share or the heavy lifting in the financial world. But if you can't get access to their, you know, cell phone, because we got that 2-point authentication that's going on, if you don't have access to their email, well, that's where everybody sends the password reset. Well, if I can't get into the email, I can't get the code for the password reset. So it becomes a domino effect. So those are things that I try to highlight because, you know, it's every evolving type of scenario. And I'm learning from, you know, the thousands of clients that I've already helped retire, you know, and passing that information on over to the new ones. And we don't want to put people in a bad situation. You know, I'm at worst case scenario, your husband's passed away. You're dealing with that tragic loss. Now you can't get access to your checking account. That's just going to create a bad situation. So those are things that I just talk about with people is, hey, let's prepare for just in case. So what I've created is I created a just in case book for people that we have on our website so that you can kind of have these conversations with your loved ones. And, you know, I even tell parents, you know, you need to share this information with your kids. Because if something happens to you and your husband, you know, then the kids or, you know, or the executors or trustees of your estate, you want to have that conversation. But a lot of people are private about that.
Well, I think it's a good idea to have this conversation. And I appreciate it because you actually mentioned a couple things that I need to make sure I have access to too. So I didn't think about his cell phone. And that is a point because I definitely thought about my computers, but that was not one of the things that I considered. So thanks for that tip. Okay, so let's maybe talk a little bit about, you know, you're in a position, you're married, and you're doing the same thing. I'm sure you've educated your wife about things that she needs to know. So I'm sure you've done your due diligence with training her as well, right?
Well, because I do this for a living, she's a writer and she's like, you know, I could really care less about this. As long as there's money in the checking account, she's like, I can care less. It's your job. So what I do is I have a Dropbox folder and I have this one password, you know, it's a file and I basically just leave breadcrumbs to her. And I always, you know, mention maybe every quarter. Do you remember how to get back into the Dropbox file? Every year I update my just in case file, which is just updating the assets, you know, 401k, Roth IRAs, you know, deferred comp programs, all those assets so that she knows how to get access to them. You know, and she doesn't really want to talk about it, you know, and I understand her position. And, you know, I just make sure that she understands, you know, here's all our life insurance policies. Here are our everything that we have, you know, so I put a plan in place and I just, every year I just update it just for her.
What a good husband you are.
Well, so, the last thing I want to do is to have her go through, you know, troubles of getting access to fund. So.
It's crazy. The things that you hear, we end up with so many of our clients, we deal with a lot of them. We talk to them about their 3-year financial model. And we help them with all of that. But, and we talk about, well, here's what you have currently in your savings. So without going through a big model like you would do. We just tell them you need to have this kind of net profit in your business every year to be able to hit your goals and to do all the things that you dream of doing, traveling to Europe once a year, buying a new house, having a second house, doing all those things. And it's really interesting how differently everybody approaches having that information. And some of them are energized by it and some are just scared to death about it. But in the end, knowledge is power. So I think it's really important to do the role that you do. So yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, on that part about your clients, you know, they all are business owners and they either own a S corp, you know, C corp and LLC. Generally, what I run into is as I talk to business owners, I ask them, okay, well, if you pass away, who's going to own your business? And they all look at me like, well, what do you mean by that? I said, well, if you part of the estate planning, because that's part of the piece of financial planning is looking at your estate, as I always say, your trust needs to own all your LLCs, and that's your small business. And the reason is that if your wife is the next successor trustee on your trust, that means that she would be able to control the business if something happens to you, you know, your wife or your spouse. And so I just recommend that, you know, this is part of the process is going back and sitting down with your attorneys every couple of years, because, you know, not only taxes will change, but estate planning laws will constantly change as well.
Which brings us to tax law changes. And that's something that you mentioned to me in our earlier conversation. What are some of the things that we need to know about, and what are some of your favorite tax strategies?
So when I look at this, there's a tax time bomb that's getting ready to happen. And what I mean by that is if you study the federal tax code from 1944 to 1963, the history of the U.S. tax rates, that was the highest tax rates that we've ever been. At some point in time, people were paying us up to 94% in federal taxes.
Wow.
During that period of time. And if you look at it, we just got out of World War II when that happened. Currently, right now, we are in one of the lowest tax brackets currently right now in 2024. The highest tax rate is 37%. Starting in 2025, President Trump, he passed the Jobs and Family Act, which lowered the tax rates from 39 to 37. Well, that goes away starting in 2026. Since that's going to go away, every consumer is going to be paying higher taxes. The standard deduction is going to be lower. The tax rates are going to go up. And oh, by the way, we have this U.S. debt clock that we, you know, if you go to usdebtclock.org and you look at, you know, the $34 trillion in their national deficit, what a lot of people don't talk about is all the 50 states have like $1.2 trillion and the locals have around $2.4 trillion. So our real debt is around $37 trillion. And that keeps on going up at a faster rate because we're paying higher interest. So what I've been talking to people about at this point in time, because things are changing and the government is really looking for more revenue, we're anticipating that tax rates are going to go up. And what we run into is retirees, you know, they don't know how their Social Security is taxed, number one. Number two, they aren't familiar with the IRMA tax. And when people find out about that IRMA tax, they really go a little crazy. What IRMA tax is that, for example, if you make over, I'll just say $190,000 and you're retired, what happens is your Medicare, they take out they kind of penalize you for making that much money. And as a result of that, it's called a Medicare surcharge for parts B and D. That starts at, you know, if you're married filing jointly, it starts at $194,000. There's a surcharge of like, you know, let's say $80 a month. But if your income goes up to $300,000, it can be up to $300 per month per person. And you pay that on a monthly basis. And why I bring that up is because everybody's been doing a great job in saving money and putting money into 401k plans, IRAs. You know, people are doing this on a, you know, at a great rate, which is great. But the problem is that the required minimum distributions that you have to start taking at 73 or 75, depending on your date of birth, can put people into a higher tax bracket at a later age. And what we're finding out is that the required minimum distributions start at 4% at age 73 or 75, depending on your age. By the time you're at age 80, you have to take out 7% of your, and that's a rough number, 7% of your assets. And then at age 85, you're at 9%. So as people are living longer, the government is forcing you to pull out more money out of these IRA accounts, which could put you in a higher tax bracket. And then, oh, by the way, insult and injury is if one of you guys pass away, not only you're dealing with the Medicare surcharge, but now if you've got a $300,000 required minimum distribution, now you're going into a single tax bracket instead of filing married with joint. And now we call that the widow's tax dilemma. So these are conversations that part of the planning that we were talking about that you need to start having, you know, at around 50, 60 years of age, because it might make more sense to do a Roth conversion, or it might make more sense to wait to take Social Security at 70 versus taking it at 65, 62, you know, whatever your full retirement age is, and going from there, because it's going to help you over the lifeline of our lives of yourself for tax purposes.
Okay.
No, I know I gave you a lot.
Yeah, you did, which is good. We want to share all we can. It's always helpful. So what's new as far as the Secure Act 1.0 and Secure Act 2.0? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in 2022, the federal government came out and the requirement distribution, and this was the Secure Act 1.0, they made a change saying that, okay, at this age, we're going to move the required minimum distributions from age 70 and a half to age 72. In Secure Act 2.0, they increased it up to 73 and 75. Mm-hmm. So what that's allowing people to do is it's allowing people to pull out money at a later, you know, a little bit longer. But one of the biggest caveats that they did in the Secure Act 1.0 is they changed how the beneficiary structures are set up. So I will go back in time. Back in 2000, George Bush set up what was called a sunset provision, basically saying if you have an IRA and the IRA goes to your spouse, that money transfers immediately to your spouse and there's no distribution. But if it transfers to your kids or to a trust, they need to take that money out based on their life expectancy. So case in point, I had a client, her mom died in 2003, left her $250,000 from her 401k plan. We've been taking out anywhere from $5,000 to $12,000 out a year based on the client's life expectancy. From 2003 to 2024, that account is still right around $280,000, even after us withdrawing money. She's taking out a little money over a period of time. The new Secure Act 1.0 is now requiring that those assets need to be pulled out of an IRA within either 5 or 10 years, depending on who the beneficiary is. And that's a major change. And what I mean by that is, a case in point, if you got $1 million in a IRA 401k plan and it now is going to your kids, what will happen is the kids will have to take that out in 10 years if the kids are the beneficiaries. If it's going to a trust, the trust will be required to pull the money out within 5 years of your death. If you do not pull the money out, the government will penalize you a 25% penalty for not taking the money out. So when you look at that, that's part of the ticking time bomb, is because we used to be able to take this out money over life expectancy. Now you have to pull this money out within 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing now is every one of my clients that put their trust as the beneficiary because they wanted to make sure the money goes to their kids, we now have to go back and change their beneficiary forms to make sure the money goes to the kids. So now we have 5 years versus 10 years. But we also are looking at how do we convert this money to a Roth. And the reason we're converting it to a Roth, because it still has to come out with either 5 or 10 years, but now that money will be tax-free for the kids if it's inside the Roth. Mm. So this new rules that they put in place has really changed the way we are doing financial planning. And it's making us kind of go back to the drawing board, and everything that we believed before has now changed based on everybody's goals and risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, and I'm sure you deal with this all the time, but each spouse has a different level of tolerance for risk.
Yes.
I might have more risk tolerance than my husband. My husband is pretty conservative. But we also butt heads every once in a while about how, you know, maybe where he's putting things.
Well, and that's part of the conversation is that what you would want to do is to make sure that if, God forbid, something were to happen to him, that you guys are on the same page so that if there is a shift. And what I generally tell people is there's a graph that people can search online. It's called the Efficient Frontier. Basically, it shows the risk versus reward. If you got 100% in stocks, this is how much risk you take versus a 50-50 split. What I have come back to people is if we start saving sooner and planning sooner, that because we are planning sooner and putting more money away, we don't really need to take that much more risk. The people who need to take the risk are the people that are late to the party. And those are the people you run into and say, hey, I've got $100,000 saved up. I want to retire in 2 years. I need a 50% rate of return. Well, that's not always going to happen. You know, there might be some days that, you know, a stock might go up 50%. But that's not, you know, you can't bet on that or bank on that. So that's why we encourage people to start as soon as possible. But as the parents are starting, as you start having kids, start introducing to them and doing that, you know, and having them plan for retirement as well. One of the biggest things that I tell business owners is that if you have kids, you can pay your kids. And since they will have earned income, the kids can make a Roth contribution based on that earned income. It's a tax benefit for you, but it also starts the clock in helping them pay, start planning. So we've all seen those graphs. If I started at age 18 and I put in, you know, $5,000 a year, you know, by the time I'm 65, I'll have like, you know, $2 million. And that's what you would want to encourage. But I would rather have $2 million tax-free versus taxable.
Well, sure. Of course. Well, let's dive into some details by decade. So let's say that somebody is 30 years old. What are a couple of things you would tell them to do besides save?
Well, besides saving is number one is usually at that stage, you're getting your life started. You know, you're buying the house, your first house, you're using the credit card, the Amazon guy's there consistently. What I encourage people to do is let's reduce our debt as quickly as possible. Let's pay the house off. You know, let's move up marginally. Let's not try to keep up with the Joneses because, you know, I don't know who the Joneses are, but trying to keep up with them is a myth, to be honest with you. So I encourage the people, you know, let's start your savings, you know, enroll in the 401k plan because usually your company gives you free money, you know, by matching. The other thing is if you work for a big corporation, I found this out when we went to Apple and we traded in for the new iPhone, I forget at the time, 13 Max Pros for all my three daughters and everything else like that. But I was talking to the manager there and he says, we get a discount on our Apple stock. And I said, really, how much? I think he said they get like a 30% discount to buy Apple stock as an employee. I said, well, have you been doing it? He said, yeah, I've been doing it. He said, there's more money in that stock program because I'm buying it at a 30% discount than buying, you know, inside my 401k plan. And they're maxed out at like $10,000 a year. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize this guy had $700,000 saved up based on what Apple has done over the last 10 years. So I encourage people, if you work for a company and they give you a discount on their stock, you know, 5, 10, 15%, whatever that discount is, that's a great, you're already stepping into a 15% rate of, you know, rate of return. So, and the 30s, you know, I think that is probably their biggest issue. You know, so I tell people, you know, do you need the latest and greatest car? The answer is no. Keep your old Honda, you know, take it to the mechanic and, you know, live within your means, because things are going to change, you know, by the time you hit 40 and 50 years of age.
Absolutely. Well, and at 30, again, you're not necessarily thinking about, it doesn't feel like it. It feels like forever.
Yeah.
Before you're going to retire.
Yeah.
Forever. I'm sitting here thinking, wow, this sure came up fast.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, it did. And now you're here. And thankfully, I'm healthy and all of that. But I think all of us, that's another thing I would say, is just be thinking about and investing in being healthy.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Because there's, yeah, like you said, there's no reason to save all this money and get to the retirement finish line. Then all of a sudden, I've got XYZ from a health situation. Now I've saved all this money. Now I can't even enjoy it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be transferred to somebody else who doesn't understand and doesn't really care about all the sacrifices that I've made. So I totally agree with you. You know, there's all these podcasts on walking and how much water you should drink. You know, I'm not a health and wellness fitness, but I do try to get out there and keep my body going in the right direction.
Oh, you're playing your basketball. I noticed that.
Yes. That is something I enjoy.
That's great. All right. So that was the 30s. And now we're at 40. And at 40 years old, a lot of people, their kids are teenagers and probably getting close to going to college. So yes. What needs to happen in 40?
And that's usually, I mean, it's a peculiar time. You know, let's say one of the parents might be a stay-at-home mom still. That would be something, you know, if you don't have a rigorous schedule, you know, maybe start introducing that person back into the workforce, if that is something that's going on. But, you know, college savings and having real conversation with their kids about college. Nobody wants to send their kid to college and pay, you know, you could buy a house for the education, you know. So I tell people, have practical conversations with your children and saying, hey, what do we want to become, you know, and let's look into doing it together as a family. And the reason is because there are more affordable ways for kids to go to college. Example, my kids go to our local community college. They can then transfer to another online college here in Columbus, Ohio. And the reason we're doing that is because it saves money. At the end of the day, I took my $3, you know, we will help you, you know, getting to college, but I'm not going to pay $40,000 a year for you to go to, you know, the Ohio State University or, you know, one of these other schools living on campus and experience the campus life. That's just not how I was raised. So I want them to have a buy-in. So that's where I would be talking to them, to parents who are in their 40s, and also balancing out and saying, okay, I believe kids need to have some type of ownership in college. So how do you balance between helping the kids out, but then also planning for your retirement at the same time?
Absolutely. Okay. And now let's go to 50. What happens at 50 that people should be thinking about?
At 50, you can see the finish line. You know, it's on that horizon. You can see it closer than you were at 30. This is the time where I would hope that people are out of debt. And at that time, you know, you get to the point, let's say for case in point, if a husband and wife are 50 years of age, they have no debt, and both of them make a combined income of $150,000 to $200,000. My goal would be is how can we live off of one of our salaries so that our retirement can be much better? The closer couples can do that, that will allow them to put money away. Let's say if, you know, they both make $75,000 and you're able to save close to $75,000 a year. That's going to allow you, and it's going to help you because inflation costs have gone up. You know, and maybe you might not be able to hit that goal every year because, you know, there might be outside circumstances, you know, like you need a new roof or a new furnace or something else like that. But it's going, at least that can be your goal, to putting more and more money away.
Okay. Well, let's take it up to 60. What happens at 60?
At 60s, if you haven't built a relationship with a financial advisor, this would be job number one. Sit down, you know, it's kind of like taking your car into the shop and get a huge diagnosis of, you know, of what's ultimately going on. So that's number one. Then from 60 to age 70, or when you plan on retirement, I generally start telling people, hey, this is when you want to have your conversations with your Social Security, Medicare. You want to start having these conversations so that you can understand the rules of the game. If you have a pension program, if you're one of the lucky people, I think 15% of people in America have pensions, you're going to want to understand what those pension programs mean and how to take that money out. I've seen a lot of people make some major mistakes with pensions, and that's, you know, terrible, you know, when they make those mistakes. But at the end of the day, you're going to want to have that conversation. And right around 60, unfortunately, we want to have that conversation about long-term care. And the reason is because long-term care insurance or health insurance or life insurance, your rates are starting to go up, but maybe if you've been blessed with not having any major illnesses or anything else like that, if you need that protection as part of your portfolio, this is the time to lock in, you know, before you get 70 plus. And if you have some ailments, now you become uninsurable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely challenging. All right, so let's talk about what questions we should be asking when we're trying to interview and find somebody to help us be an advisor.
Yeah, one of the questions I tell people, and a lot of advisors don't like that when I ask, and the reason I tell people to do this is when I first got into the business back in, you know, let's say 1999, 98, I didn't know anything. I worked for JPMorgan Chase. They took us through this, you know, two-month-long sales training process, and they basically threw me out in front of the wolves just to try to sell anything. So one of the biggest things you're going to ask is, okay, what's your portfolio? What are you invested in? How much money are you saving? Questions like that, because I'll be honest with you, when I was 25, 26, when I first got into the business, I didn't know anything, you know, but I worked for JPMorgan Chase and I sat in the banking centers and we sold products to people that we didn't even really know and totally understand. So that would be the first question is, you know, tell me more about your experience. How long have you been in the business? Because at the end of the day, you don't want to be sitting down, you know, with your hard-earned money with a novice and kind of going from there. That's usually the first question, and that will probably weed out 50% of the advisors. The second thing is, you know, you want to understand where your advisor works at. And without going into a long dissertation about every firm, but each firm has their own sweet spot on how they are compensated. Me being an independent advisor, meaning I don't represent, you know, a bank, I don't represent a wirehouse. I represent myself. I'm a fiduciary, and that's what we are held by, the fiduciary standard. I'm not just pitching one product. So unfortunately, you know, if you have an advisor that works for, you know, XYZ company, that XYZ company is only giving them access to a small shelf life of products and services that you can use. So those would be the first questions I would ask. Is, you know, how are you compensated? You know, where's your money going? How much money are you saving? How many people have you worked with? You know, can I have referrals, you know, from some of your clients? And then, you know, once they give you a list of, you know, 5 to 10 clients, call the clients up and ask them every question. How long have you been working with Walter? What do you like about Walter? What don't you like about Walter? How often do you meet with them? Because you want to know what's going to happen. Another question I would ask your advisors, how many clients do you currently serve? And that's something a lot of people don't ask. When I worked for JPMorgan Chase, no longer working there, I left in 2008. I had over 900 clients.
Oh my gosh.
Exactly. And I was one of the number one sales reps in Columbus, is because I had the biggest book of business and I had 900 clients and I had a part-time sales assistant. I was working 70, 80 hours a week, you know, generating revenue for the company. Now, I remember one day I was walking past one of my clients that didn't have a huge relationship with me, But I walked past the husband and wife, and I looked at them in my eye, and I said, well, for some reason, I know who those people are, but their name is escaping me. You know, 5 minutes later, I recognize, oh, that's one of my clients, you know, and kind of going from there. And that's when I recognize, are we really adding value to people, or are we just trying to sell something? So if your advisor has, you know, 800, 900 clients, but let's say they have a team of 20, you know, advisors with them, then that makes sense. But if they are, you know, working for a bank, you know, nothing against a bank, but if they have 900 clients, how are they really going to add value to you? You're just a number. So that's something you have to look at, you know, and some people like being a number.
I hear you. I kind of like to know the people I deal with.
Yeah.
Them to know my name too. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's wrap up today. And why don't you share 3 takeaways that you would like to share with our listeners?
Yes.
Keep in mind that probably 85% of our listeners are female.
Yeah. So the first thing that I would recommend is planning, planning, planning. I think, you know, for your listeners, you have to create a just-in-case plan. If something happens to me, if I'm the business owner, if something happens to my husband, you have to start planning for it. So that's where you need a just-in-case plan. The second thing is taxes, taxes, taxes. For every business owner, you know, we deal with this, you know, dreaded self-employment tax, you know, so that pushes you into that 40% tax rate. And it's great, you know, you have $1 million in sales, but yet you owe the government $500,000. Well, that's terrible. So what are ways that you can reduce your taxes? You know, there's different types of retirement plans and going from there. And the third, probably the most important thing, which falls in line with taxes, should you be converting some of your assets into a Roth for estate planning purposes, but then also to reduce my future taxes down the road? So those would be the 3 takeaways that I would be advising all your listeners to have conversations, you know, not only with their advisor, with their spouse, you know, with their team, and kind of going from there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing your advice today. It was great interviewing you and having time with you. And we'll make sure to post contact information on our show notes. So we'll get that information from you as well, because I know you had a few free resources for everyone.
Yes.
Perfect.
I appreciate your time, and I thank you. And hopefully we can add some value.
Thank you so much.
No matter your stage in life or in business, hopefully you came away from this episode with a new piece of financial knowledge and maybe even a new component of your financial plan. If you want to learn more about the business coaching services we offer, go to thepearlcollective.com. For more episodes of this podcast, you can subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, our YouTube channel Pearl Collective, or by checking the podcast page on your website. To gain access to the resources that Walter mentioned in this podcast, please see the show notes on our website.